We're here on episode 10, the conclusion of series 1, which is going to be on the subject of poetry, therapy and the academy. And for this episode, we're picking up on some themes of well-being and academic life that we introduced throughout our first series. And I'm really delighted to have here Dr. Stephanie Aspin, who I've known for a number of years, I've known since 2005, I think, Steph, that we've been,
2004,
been around.
2004, 5, yeah.
And that was when I started my PhD at the University of East Anglia, and Steph, you were, I think, a researcher developer at that point.
Yes, that's right.
So we've got a history that's almost 20 years where we've known each other
yes.
in different capacities. So I've known you initially when you were actually supporting me with research training and helping me understand what it was to do a PhD. And then I've sort of worked with you a bit as an academic developer as well,
yep.
so in academic development. And we'll hear more about that in just a moment. But one of the big things that I wanted to sort of highlight for this episode is your new book, which has just come out. And
yep.
You very kindly... signed it for me, so I've now
got it's the only one.
Well, it's I very much enjoyed it.
Thank you for asking.
It's been a pleasure. I've even got a little smiley face with the signature, which is great. And it's called Poetry and Therapy: Why Words Help, and it's published by PCCS Books in 2025. So this year, it's only been out a couple of months. And I'm probably going to embarrass you a little bit, but I'm going to just look at the blurb on the back. And it was being described as a, and I'm quoting here, a rich, intelligent, and I've underlined this bit, deeply humane offering.
I'm blushing now.
that weaves together the power of poetry, therapeutic insight, and philosophical depth. And we will be picking up on the kind of content of that book throughout the episode. But also really I think the key thing today is lessons that we can learn from combining different scholarly and professional interests, because you are somebody who I think is quite remarkable in terms of your career. One of the few people I know who's actually got 2 PhDs.
So. I don't know if I dignify it with the word career, but unless you mean the sort of careering down a hill.
Well, let's listen to your academic origin story then,
yeah.
in your own words. And so, Steph, welcome to the show and take it away. Thank you.
So my academic origin story. So I started out doing literature at the University of East Anglia, who I was very pleased they accepted me with my very poor A-levels. But I've always absolutely loved literature, but exclusively poetry. And one of the great things about doing the degree, the BA in English Lit at UEA, was that it allowed me to specialise from quite early on. So I've always been very interested in avant-garde poetry, contemporary poetry and poetics, and alongside that as well, a bit literary theory, as you know, I developed as a student. So that was always, you know, from being a really small child, a real special interest, poetry, how words work. So there wasn't much choice really when it came to doing degrees. I was just drawn towards it, and then subsequently went on to do an MA at Sussex, followed by a PhD. So I started my PhD at the University of Liverpool, and then transferred with my supervisor to Dundee, but was based in Norwich. So my husband was doing his PhD in economics at the University of East Anglia, and worked here subsequently. So I've been in Norwich for a long time, and around postgraduate students in Norwich. So I started teaching after I finished my PhD part-time. As I said, my career, such as it's been, has been very unplanned. So I think, as many literature PhDs do, I'm sort of teaching part-time, I was teaching at Brunel and various other places. I'm moving around the country a little bit with my husband's job. I think economists in the main are a bit more employable. But, you know, I'm not, you know, undermining the value of the PhD in literature. We have many skills. So I did that for a while and then ended up working at UEA, mainly because I wanted to come back to Norwich. And as Matthew said, working in research development, which I absolutely loved, and then subsequently running the MA in higher education practice, which is the teaching qualification for staff. So that was absolutely brilliant. I did that till 2023. But when I started the job at UEA, I was still living in London and commuting. So I needed to do something with my Wednesday evening. And that turned out to be an evening class. And the one that was available on a Wednesday evening was counselling. So again, you know, I wandered into it without much thought, like most of the decisions that I make in life. I tend to go on vibe and what interests me, and it really interested me. So I did the introductory course, did the certificate course, then did a full training as an integrative therapist. So that was the BSc course at Middlesex, and then hadn't had enough of it. So I carried on and did a PhD here in counselling studies, focusing on the relationship between poetry, language, and the psyche. So the book itself is a bit different. It's not, it does contain practical exercises, but it's not maybe the sort of book that you might expect in poetry therapy. It's not focused so much on practice, but it balances it out with literary theory and poetics, you know, which is my first love. So it was actually a brilliant project to do as a PhD. I ran workshops, you know, interviewed people. A lot of people really kindly donated writing, you know, worked with clients. So it was really interesting, and that subsequently turned into the book.
Thank you, Steph. I mean, it really came through the way that you've combined these different interests in your career. So there's quite a few personal anecdotes in the book, I think, in both in terms of your kind of therapeutic, your professional background, but I think also in your life as well. So sort of personal stories about your experience of dealing with sometimes quite difficult subjects, and challenging subjects. And I think we're going to, I guess, get on to looking at poetry in just a moment. But one of the things that you on your website you've kind of defined yourself as is a neurodivergent therapist. And back in episode 5 on this podcast, we were looking at neurodivergence and the PGR experience, which I think has really sort of started to define that term a bit more in relation to something like neurodiversity. But do you mean, maybe just for the benefit of the listeners, and also me, because I'm not quite sure necessarily, what is it to be a neurodivergent therapist in your experience?
Yeah, so in my experience, it's not to be an expert in neurodivergence, although I have really developed my expertise since finding out I was neurodivergent, which is another story and part of the PhD journey, which you may come on to. But it's to be a therapist that has lived experience working with people with lived experience, which I think is really important. You know, my whole approach to neurodiversity, or neurodivergence rather, is that it is a way of being systemically marginalised. And I think that it really is helpful if people that are systemically marginalised in that way have therapists that have experience of that. So we don't raise our eyebrows, for example. I don't think we do tend to gaslight people by saying, "Oh, are you sure?" You know, because it's been within our own experience. And it's really important as a therapist to be able to park your own experience as well. Every neurodivergent person is different. You know, and we shouldn't bring our experiences and interpret other people's experiences through our own lens. That said, however, I do think it is really helpful if you are neurodivergent and you want therapy to find somebody that is a neurodivergent therapist, is neurodivergent themselves. You know, pretty much, you know, that a black woman will be best served probably by a black woman therapist. because, you know, of that experience of systemic marginalisation. You know, I'm not comparing the two things, racism and disability, but I do think, you know, we can look at them through the same lens. I think that is helpful.
Thank you. Thanks, Steph. I think that's really helpful to maybe understand part of the work you do, although the book itself is not, you know, it's not purely a book about neurodivergence or
I think I've mentioned it maybe once or twice, yeah.
But it is an aspect of your professional life,
yeah.
And one of the things that you also have mentioned on your website, and I know you've sent me a great flyer about this as well, is Atypicats.
Yeah.
Which is a consultancy that you work with yep. training,
yeah,
development.
It's a collective, mm-hmm. which is really important to us. So we work, we have a very flat structure, there's three of us. We're all co-founders. And we basically work with universities in the main. We've worked with a couple of mental health providers as well, but we tend to work with universities because we know what it is to be a university insider. We also know what it is to be neurodivergent. And we run workshops. We're partnering with the University of London at the moment, so last year and next semester, to run, I suppose, their sort of awareness-raising sessions for staff and managers. And they've been absolutely brilliant, actually. I think the University of London are really ahead of the curve when it comes to thinking about neurodiversity. But I think it's particularly important in the HE context, because I think so many academics, doctoral candidates, are neurodivergent, whether or not they're identified, because neurodivergence is a very interesting and nuanced type of disability. So it is a disability, you know, there are things that we can't do and that are difficult under the medical model,
yeah.
But it's also largely a disability using the social model of disability, i.e. the world's not set up for us. I think universities used to be very much set up for us, so special interests, quiet places, libraries and that kind of thing, but I think as we've moved to more of a business model as a sector, more shared offices, shared spaces, more administration, I think that's become maybe quite difficult for a lot of people that may not have needed a diagnosis or to recognise they were neurodivergent before, because they were working with what they do best, which is ideas, research, you know, in a quiet space.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly recognise that. I think, I mean, I've had a much shorter career in academia than many of my senior colleagues, but I think over the last sort of 20-odd years, I've definitely seen a rise in kind of personal administrative duties that happen, and I think that happens at all levels. It's happening for research students and students generally, and it's happening for established academic staff as well. So we'll have a look at the academy, the sort of third part of our discussion today, towards the end of the episode. But I thought maybe we could start off by looking at poetry, which is
poetry.
Not at all my specialism. But I was absolutely engrossed by the ideas that you put forward in that. And I, you know, full disclosure, I did an English Lit A level, and that was about the kind of the extent of my poetry knowledge. So, on page 16 of the book, so quite early on. And I thought this was really helpful because it's
getting like a fiver now. I'm trying to remember.
So you talk about really four functions of poetry,
yeah.
And I think maybe if we could sort of like treat each of one of these in turn, and then hopefully listeners will be able to see how or hear how this goes on to relate to therapeutic functions as well. So the first one, I guess, is poetry and telling and symbolising. Mm. So symbolising is quite a big theme of your book. Could you explain a bit about what that's about? What do we mean about telling and symbolising?
Symbolising. So I suppose what I mean is that telling, I guess, would be the most basic function, you know, to actually speak about something in therapy that maybe we haven't spoken about before or haven't spoken about in that way. But part of that process is finding language that will adequately hold it, what Eliot calls the objective correlative, the words, you know, the only words that can hold that experience. And I think that's why poetry is really important, because you can't summarise a poem. You know, and A level, GCSE particularly, being asked to do that, absolute rubbish. You know, a poem is extant. You know, it's sounds, it is the shapes of the words, it is everything about it, which is why translation is an art, you know, and not a science. I forgot where I was going with this now. Yeah, symbolisation. So yeah, finding the right image, and I think when we find the right image, we're right at the edge of what we know often, that we may not know why that's the right image, why we're drawn towards it. And you may have had this experience when you're reading a poem or encountering a work of art, and that brings us to a place of curiosity and exploration, which is where we want to be working as therapists. So people often have experiences of therapy where they will have years of therapy where they'll go in, tell the same story, we call it rehearsed material, which is, you know, not to denigrate that, you know, we've all done it, but it means we're stuck. But I think when we find the right image, a door opens, you know, because that image is bringing its own associations we may not be aware of, associations that are personal, in culture, and it gives us an object, I suppose, to put on the table and to start turning over to explore.
Mm. Thanks, Steph. I like the imagery discussions that you have in there, and it was a little bit surprising to me, because I didn't, in my naivety, I didn't understand the idea of imagery and literature, in a sense,
right.
Because I came from some visual arts background through my earlier academic life, and always had a bit.
I took on the visual arts as well.
Yeah, this idea of objects and the idea of kind of images, we're talking here about largely mental images that are kind of coming into people's minds when they're reading text. But you talk a lot as well about this kind of plasticity of or kind of variety of meaning that comes out of words chosen for poetry, that there isn't necessarily one kind of fixed meaning or description that's being used. There's actually kind of a range of associations or connotations that come in. And is that how we're getting into the symbolism side of things here?
I think that's what poetry brings to the table. Right. When you read words in a poem, you are alerted that there may be multiple meanings. You know, poetry uses metaphor, motif, symbol, rhythm, all of that. And it draws our attention to it. So even if you take regular language, you know, everyday language, I'm looking at a poster that says switch off the speakers and close the windows when you leave. You know, in this context, I'm just reading that as a message.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, if I presented that as a poem, we would then start to dwell on it and be a bit more curious. And, you know, when we start to unpick language, we can see that words have other associations that aren't active. So I know what meanings are active in this context. You know, it's a set of instructions. But actually, if we broke it down and looked at the relationships, if we looked at the connotations of words, the relationships, spatial relationships even, between words, we would then find out more. It's about being curious. So, I mean, words, I mean, this is a, I don't want to get too deep or offend anyone that's an expert, but it's, you know, Lacan talks about the chain of signification. Lacan is was a French psychoanalyst and theorist who defined himself as a Freudian, but actually moved the whole Freudian project, I suppose, the psychoanalytic project, on to talk about language. And he says that what happens when we grow up, when we acquire language, we then move into language. And language is something that exists in the world. So when we use language, when we pick up a word, we're picking up a whole chain of meaning. So in the book, I use the example of the word chair. So in this context, if it said, it says here, please return any chairs you've taken.
And I didn't put these posters up
before we started. See, language is everywhere.
It is, yeah.
You can find a poem everywhere. So, you know, I know this is they mean the chairs that we're sitting on. But actually, you know, think about chair and culture. You think about the chair of a meeting. You might think personally about, I don't know, the chair that your grandfather sat in. You might think about a specific chair. So chairs have lots of meanings. And when we're drawn towards an image, when we're drawn towards language, poetry does this. It asks us to attend, not just to take the surface. And that place of curiosity, I think, is a place of therapy.
Fantastic. I'm really pleased that we could use the poster, the instructions and on the wall in front of us as a good example of poetry. And I'm starting to see actually how incredibly poetic these instructions are. So moving on to a couple of other functions that you mentioned. So there were two more, containment and transformation. I was really taken with containment. Do you want to sort of unpack that a bit for listeners as well? What do you mean by that?
It's something that's talked about a lot in therapy, particularly in relation to trauma. So having something that will contain an experience. So art therapy is often used with trauma, visual art therapy, because it gives a containing space, you know, that you can do a drawing rather than be in the experience. You've got something outside of you that's actually holding the emotion and the experience. And poetry can similarly, poetic images can act as containers. So we can talk about, I don't know, you know, if we talked about our, I'm looking at the wall again, if we talked about our experiences as, you know, a machine, for example, I can see restart the machine. You know, that might be a container to think about. So what would restarting the machine be? And you could talk about that image. But in talking about that image, then we can start to connect to our experience, awaken some of our experiences. So, I mean, you could say restart the machine would be quite a good motif to maybe describe the therapeutic process.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, it's slightly ironic, given that we had some problems with starting the machine in the studio next door. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can see how that would work. So it's that act of giving a kind of a frame around something that the client or patient can work with to begin to work through the concern that they've got, the thing that they've got a block with, whether it's a traumatic experience that they're trying to sort of process, or something, you know, something else that they brought to the session.
Well, there's a very good, talking about poetry, people are probably familiar, if you're a literature person anyway, with Keats' Ode on a Grecian Urn, which I think is just a perfect image. He talks about, you know, he encounters this urn with a scene on it in a gallery, he's walking past it, and then he starts to dwell on the scene. And then he walks away from it, but he also tells us that's still going on. So it's almost that image on the urn, you know, it's an image of containment. It's containing emotion, it's containing action, it's containing experience. And I think that's a perfect image for what, you know, the ways in which artistic images, whether they're poetic or visual, can contain an experience.
This kind of leads us on, I guess, to this idea of transformation. So what does that mean in terms of poetry? How does poetry transform? I'm guessing the people who read it or people who make it, or a bit of both.
Well, there's two levels, I suppose. There's the more, I suppose, prosaic level, paradoxically talking about poetry, but you can find a better image, you know, through poetry, through writing, a better way to frame experience, something that is more comfortable, more satisfying, more inspiring. And that is a very helpful thing to do in therapy. I do a lot of creative arts therapy, and a lot of that work is about finding, you know, how we can transform an experience, find a better way of expressing it and holding it. But the other bit of that is that I think as humans, and this is where the book becomes a bit esoteric in the later chapters, that we very much go to language to make something happen. So if you think about magic, if you think about spells, if you think about religion, forms of words are incredibly important, and we seem to have as a species a belief that if we say the right words in the right order, something will change. And we can even find that in the everyday. So everyday phrases like, I don't know, touch wood, or I can't think of a good one, but it seems to be an innate thing. We like that. I suppose the word would be ritual of language.
Yeah.
You know, nursery rhymes, another, children are very drawn towards nursery rhymes, and they are containers, but also they seem to contain something that's a little beyond our day-to-day experience.
I think, I mean, that's really, I think that's one of the things that really stayed with me when reading the book, actually, with the idea of ritual, and I think we'll come on to that towards the end of the programme, particularly in relation to academic life, because I think there's some interesting loss of rituals to a certain extent, which we can talk about. So thank you for taking us through your kind of poetry functions. The next topic in the episode today was actually around therapy, and we've already started to kind of get there a bit with your role and the kind of professional work that you're doing. And I guess there were two processes, therapeutic processes, that stood out for me. One was the person-centered approach, and the other is psychoanalysis. And I'm pleased to say I know a little bit about both, normally in a kind of, the former in an educational context, but through the work of Carl Rogers, who I'm a big, very big advocate of that approach. The second, psychoanalysis, way back in my art history days, because that was, psychoanalysis was actually something that's kind of had an interesting afterlife in relation to lots of other subject areas, and the visual arts is no exception, I think, to that. So do you want to maybe just explain how those two things kind of, how you work with person-centered approach and psychoanalysis, and what the difference between those two things is, in a nutshell?
This is very Bible-like now.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, so I'm an integrative therapist, but my basic practice is person-centered. So person-centered approach is based on seeing the client's experiences as much as possible through their eyes, and helping people to take the way they judge themselves from the outside into the inside, which is really important in the work that I do with neurodivergent people, particularly autistic clients, that we very much learn to judge ourselves from the outside, which is a normal thing. It's a protective strategy for humans. You know, we need to fit in with the group to survive, so that's hardwired. But when you're neurodivergent, you're aware that you are doing things differently, and that's too neutral a word. Actually, you're doing things wrong, so you often criticise. So we modify our behaviour based on input from the outside. And the way in which we do that is to internalise, to install a version of ourselves which is very self-critical. So where's I going with that? Yeah, so that's the person-centred bit, is to move that evaluation of self from the outside, what's called an external locus of evaluation in Rogers, to an internal locus of evaluation, where we can evaluate our own experiences more accurately, based on our own, registering of it in our being, I suppose. And that is the therapeutic process. So that's the work that I do. But the way that I do it, I do use a lot, like you, I came across psychoanalysis early on, studying literature, and always been really interested in those ideas. So the first PhD I did, which was on the New York School poet Ted Berrigan, who was around in the 1970s, was about how a self is constructed, a sense of a self, even when that self is gone, because he was dead by that point. When you read Berrigan's work, you get a sense you're talking to a person. So I was thinking, well, how is that trick done in language? You know, the work is very conversational, and you really do, when you work, those of you who've got the experience of doing a single author PhD will resonate with this. You know, you feel like you really know that person. You know, it's my mate Ted. I even went to New York and went to his corner store and had a Pepsi and a Twinkie, because that's what he did. And that was one of the peak moments of my life, was having that Pepsi in Gem Spa in the East Village. But anyway, I digress. Yeah, so the psychoanalysis. Yeah, I think psychoanalysis, it's become unfashionable, but I think it has really interesting things to say about imagery. It has interesting things to say about the self. It focuses very much on the idea of the unconscious. So coming back to that idea of the image can make us curious to step into a space that we're not fully aware of. That really interests me. You know, not what's rehearsed and known, but what is unknown. That's absent from Rogers, but Rogers is very much reacting to Freudian orthodoxy. So when he was training as a psychologist, the psychoanalytic approach was the norm. So I think there is a lot, this may be controversial, shout back at me, but I think there's quite a lot in Rogers that takes from Freud.
Mm.
So for example, the idea of the external locus of evaluation, you can make some steps towards the superego, which is the moral bit that berates us, that we, you know, develop in our encounters growing up with society. Again, very pertinent to the work that I do with autistic people and neurodivergent people more generally. But yes, I'm quite interested. I was interested in the theory. So when I first started off as a therapist, the psychoanalytic interest was very much academic, based on the PhD. So the first PhD I did was looking at language, was looking at Lacan, who I mentioned earlier. So in that, very much that psychoanalytic arena, but I never brought that into therapy. I was always very much a person-centered person. But as I've trained in creative arts therapy and been working more with poetry, with painting, it started to spill in, because I think there were really useful, interesting ideas and techniques that we can take from psychoanalysis. So I'm not a psychoanalyst by any means. I don't work psychoanalytically, but I do draw ideas from that space, you know, and blend them with a more person-centered approach, which I know would horrify a lot of person-centered therapists. So you say, feel free to scream at me.
I'm not horrified at all. I think it's really fascinating, because actually, well, one of the things we missed off a few moments ago was the fourth function of poetry that you introduced, yeah, in the book, which is the access to the unconscious.
Yeah.
And I think that certainly around psychoanalysis, I think, mm, is a very useful way of trying to conceptualize that. Mm. I guess you mentioned when you were talking about Berrigan,
mm,
that this issue of the self and, mm, the kind of conversation or dialogue that you enter into. And one of the chapters of your book deals with how people are working with and through identity in their poetic works. And you reprint a number of poems that have been produced by, mm, some people who actually are poets. They're actually professional, yep, poets. They might be clients that you've had. I think this was kind of from a workshop context that, yeah, you were working with before. But do you, I mean, maybe say a little bit more about that idea of the self and identity and how poetry does, you know, works with that for people.
It's something I'm thinking about at the moment, so I don't really know where to start with it. But I think that all art, you know, including poetry, when you're engaging in the practice of art, you're engaging in a practice of exploring the self, you're exploring your experience, and in doing that, you're laying something down that says something about your identity, who I am now. And that can even be art that is quite formal, you know, because we are going through a process of choosing what to look at, you know, choosing words, choosing colours, choosing shapes and forms. So there's something about, you know, when we act, when we move into this space, that we are acquiring agency, which is really important. You know, big part of breakdowns is a sense of a loss of agency. But also, you know, identity, we're actually seeing ourselves, seeing some process of ourselves made manifest, you know, whether that is, you know, in a visual form or in writing. I don't know if that answers your question. And I think that's always true. There's a I mentioned it in the book that people often split what is poetry written for therapy and artistic practice. And I understand that because nobody, no writer wants their work to be only read biographically. You know, that is to take away from the artistry. But actually, I do think there is still this encounter with biography, however you define that, in all art, because there is this process of choosing what to represent, how to represent it, and an exploring of your own experience as an artist.
Thanks, Steph. I think that sort of exploration that you've been talking about there, it might sort of take us on neatly to the last bit of our episode today, our conversation, which is around the Academy, because as we said at the beginning of the episode, and as you've explained, you do tend to specialise a lot with higher education as a context.
Yeah.
Not exclusively, but you've had most experience in higher education.
Yeah. Most of my clients come from HE or from the arts.
Yeah. And I think that's maybe a good sort of springboard for us to think a bit about, you know, without obviously disclosing details of those situations and those client relationships that you have, but maybe some sort of top level challenges of academic life that might be, you know, might create space for people to actually use some of the techniques that you've talked about in the book and maybe explore that further through therapeutic support if they seek that. So, and you started to allude to that in, I guess, in relation to neurodivergence a few minutes ago. So, I mean, what's your kind of understanding of these common challenges of academic life in particular that seem to that people bring to therapy now?
I mean, the key one, I was talking to some colleagues who are neurodivergent therapists as well, and nobody ever comes to see us, for example, to talk about their autism. It's always to talk about the challenges of being autistic in the world. So I suppose in academia, the most common challenge is a misunderstanding of what we call the spiky profile of autism in particular, but neurodivergence in general. And that leads to a lot of negative self-talk. So I was talking about this image, you know, negative self-image that we introject. And that's very much bound up with shame, because this misunderstanding of the spiky profile that's been misunderstood our whole lives feels like our fault. So to give you an example, what I mean by the spiky profile is, and this, you know, applies particularly in academia, is that neurodivergent people can be really good at some things. So a neurodivergent brain, an autistic brain, for example, and then the terms aren't interchangeable. Neurodiversity is an umbrella term. Neurodivergence, rather, is an umbrella term for a whole range of conditions. But I tend to work with autism and ADHD, autism in particular. But an autistic brain is incredibly sensitive. It's incredibly lit up. And the research is really moving on with autism. Understanding, you know, it's to do with genetic differences, it's to do with brain growth with the neonate, it's to do with these connections not shutting down in a way that it does in a neurotypical brain. So everything's very turned up, we're very sensitive. So that means that we can often, not always, you know, this superpower narrative I know is very harmful, but often when people find themselves in academia, they can do some things really well. Because we're good at pattern spotting, we're very sensitive. Maybe for an artist, you know, our arts practice might be based on, you know, autistic gifts, I suppose. But other things that seem very ordinary and obvious, we will really struggle with for various reasons. So parts of the brain are working overdrive in a neurodivergent brain, other bits not so well. You know, to give a really dumbed down explanation, but so it might be things like, you know, in my case, when we switched over to holiday bookings being online, I suddenly was de-skilled rather than doing a paper booking, because I couldn't understand. I have trouble when there's too much on a screen. My brain has trouble sorting it, so I can't fill dates and I make very basic mistakes. I'm very bad with diaries, even paper diaries, that if I turn a page, I can't retain what was on the previous page. Mm. I get lost. So when I was working at one place in London, I couldn't, the institution was split into two bits, with the general office being in one building, my office being in another building. I couldn't find my way, so I used to get lost all the time. Mm. And I've had that since I was a child, you know, not being able to find my way. I'm not very good at, so for example, I would struggle to fly somewhere on my own. Mm. And that's quite embarrassing as an adult, to say, yeah, I'd love to come, but actually I'm not going to be able to get there because I'm not going to be able to get on the right plane. So there are lots of things that bring us a lot of shame as neurodivergent people. Mm. So I think in the work context, in the academic context, you maybe can see how this would map over. So, you know, not meeting deadlines, being late, not being able to read a timetable, not understanding feedback on your PhD. Meetings are really draining. So anything that's back to back, I can't do. And that's really difficult in academia because we're all so busy. You know, it's like, oh, let's talk over lunch. Well, no, I actually need to go to a dark room at lunchtime to recover so I can manage the afternoon. Mm. So we always find ourselves making excuses, you know, finding cubby holes. Literally, you'll find neurodivergent people over universities in the whole country that are in cleaning cupboards for 10 minutes, toilets, quiet corner. I can tell you every quiet corner of the UEA campus. You know, every quiet corner. If anyone wants a tip, bottom of the lecture theatres, there's a little bench right out of the way if you need a quiet 10 minutes. But yeah, so it's very shaming. So, you know, we're often seen to be able to do quite high, you know, highly valuable intellectual things, but not be able to do something like order lunch. Or, you know, we tend to eat the same food all the time, so we don't like surprises. That can be quite embarrassing. Yeah. Does that kind of answer your question? So it's around admin, I suppose. The spiky profile is so shaming because it's so misunderstood.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Steph, for sharing your personal experience of that, because we had Cassia Hayward-Fitch on the podcast a few months ago, who was our Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Ambassador for the CHASE Doctoral Training Partnership. And she was talking about reasonable adjustments in institutions and how I think universities are now, they've started to realise that there's a certain amount of responsibility there to acknowledge and respond to the more social model of disabling that can happen very often, because the systems and the spaces that we have in organisations like universities are set up for very particular profiles of people. So I think that's really, I mean, that's a really useful way of understanding, I guess, the importance of your work. One question that I had sort of as we sort of draw this to a close, I guess, is around coming back to this idea of ritual and what that has, you know, where there's a space for that. And I and this is my own little observation here, so apologies for throwing this in, but I often hear stories from PhD students, for instance, about the submission of their thesis. So this is the culmination of several years of, like, you know, really hard work. Many of the challenges that you've just described that people might be going through as well, so there's an extra layer of that, all of sort of life challenges, admin responsibilities, etc., and there being a sense of kind of anticlimax, a kind of deflation, or a kind of maybe, you know, not, there's no sort of marking of transition from one state to another state, and I was minded of that because of some of the things that you were talking about in the book around ritual practices, and particularly those that kind of relate to things like, you know, sort of sympathetic magic and, you know, things that symbolic acts that are designed to affect change in the world, or rather affect change in the psyche, I suppose. One of the interesting examples that happens in Sweden, my wife's from southern Sweden, and I've heard this in Uppsala and Lund as two of the oldest universities in Sweden, is that they actually nail copies of the thesis to a wall in a department. Something called the Speakning.
That's a brilliant idea. I love that.
And it's there's been all sorts of reasons for why they do this. Some of it going back to sort of Lutheran Protestantism and the nailing of the 95 Theses in Wittenberg and stuff. So there's kind of a history.
Yeah, I've got the reference. That's where my brain was going. It's great.
Yeah, and I like the idea of sort of driving a nail through a physical copy of a thesis that you've been writing. I'm not sure that I should recommend people do it here, but that to me is always, it's very much felt like a symbolic kind of act. That's a very physical thing to do, to sort of mark a transition or a change in identity from somebody who's kind of doing a PhD to sort of finishing a PhD. And then also graduation ceremonies, which we had here just a few weeks
ago. Incredibly ritualistic.
Very ritualistic. Yeah. You sort of building on that, which is very visible, it's very active, it's very performative, I suppose. What do you see kind of are the uses of poetry as, you know, playing into ritual in academic life? I mean, is it possible for, you know, somebody in academia right now to deploy poetry to facilitate the way that they manage the challenges of the academic world, maybe outside of a therapeutic context?
That's a big question.
Sorry, that was a very long question, wasn't it? I realised. That was probably about three questions.
I suppose, I mean, I can think of, you know, ways in which you would deploy poetry. I think reading poetry publicly, I think having a form of words that is said, you know, if you think about marriage ceremony, for example, is really important. It makes you feel something, you know, something is completed. You know, and I love that idea of nailing the book up, you know, to do an act and let yourself know. But yeah, I could imagine, you know, that there was maybe something read when the book is handed in. That would be, I think, probably psychologically helpful. So I can't remember your question. Do you want to refine it?
I mean, I guess it's how poetry, the sort of role of poetry really in everyday academic life, you know, how people might be able to turn to poetry for ways of making meaning or kind of meeting some of those challenges in the academy.
I suppose that what poetry tells us is that words matter, you know, every word matters. So, you know, if you think about the graduation ceremony, which I've sat through many on both sides of the fence, you know, they have an opening format. You know, they hit the drums and they declare it open, they declare it closed. That's a very poetic act. That's not an act of, we know it's open, we can see, we know you're finished, but actually it's a very ritual, performative, as you said, way of using language. So that's the way I see, rather than using particular poems, which I think is another way. I talk about my mum's death in the book. You know, I'm reading Wordsworth at her funeral. Was incredibly affecting for me. It was an act of closure. You know, there's a bit in the prelude of somebody being, you know, the poet's freed and from prison, imprisonment, and, you know, reading that said more than I could say, coming back to words being a container. So I suppose, yeah, finding forms of words to mark particular points would, I think, be really helpful. You know, I could imagine, you know, you're going, I mean, everything's uploaded now, which I think is, I understand the reason for that, but it's kind of, maybe we need something on top of that.
Yeah,
maybe there could be, you know, a designated member of the library team that that says, you know, rings a bell and says this is finished. Yeah. So I think we need to know psychologically. I think these things are really important. And if you look back hundreds of thousands of years, we were performing symbolic acts, you know, cave paintings, things that don't seem to be of any use. You know, anthropologists think, well, this must be ritual. Yeah, so it's something deep in the psyche. Yeah. So, yeah, I think forms of words are really important. And I think, you know, the more we can bring them into it to mark these points of transition, I think the better.
Yeah. Thanks ever so much for those insights. I'm certainly going to be, as a result of this, reading your book and this wonderful conversation, I'll be keeping an eye out for lines of poetry that actually resonate, I think, in a way. It's actually rather coincidentally, last night my wife told me that she'd found the poem she wants me to read at her funeral.
Right.
Which I suppose is... I feel slightly kind of ambivalent about that at the moment, but I'm kind of still trying to work around it. But I do need to listen to it. I find it quite hard sometimes to listen to people reading out poetry or reading out prose. But I should really sit and listen to her read that and look at it and look at what and pay attention to what the words mean. Yeah,
because it's something of a container.
Yeah. Thank you, Steph.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
It's been enjoyed. It's been a joy. It's great to see you again.
Wasn't anything like a Viber at all.
I tried to make these conversations unviber-like. We'd like to obviously make sure that listeners can find you. So where do people find out about your work and your services, I guess?
So I've got a website, so it's stephanieaspin.com. You can also find me on Instagram. There's also the Atypicats website, atypicats.com. We offer consultancy, training, and also increasingly coaching. So if you're interested in coaching, you can try us there. Where else am I? That's about it, I suppose.
Great.
I'm not massively over social media, but I'm a little bit.
I think you're very findable, which is always good. And how can people get hold of your new book? This is Poetry and Therapy, Why Words Help.
Yeah, so the book's available from the publisher website, which is PCCS Books. On Amazon, it's available from Waterstones, I think pretty much anywhere really.
Fantastic, Steph. Absolute joy to have this time together. It's been great.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it too. Yeah. Really a pleasure, Matthew.
And I know, I think it's your holiday as well.
Yes, August. Yeah, I keep the academic ritual of August.
Yeah, well, you've come into the studio today to record on your holiday, so that's incredibly
kind.
You
know what August means when we say holiday? Writing.
Yeah, that's right. Great. Well, I wish you all the very best with your future projects.
Thank
with
you.
The Atypicats group and collective. And I really do hope we can hear more from your work in the future. So
thank you. It's been lovely.
Thank you.